Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 68. This episode was ready to go yesterday on Thanksgiving, but somehow it didn't seem quite right to be publishing an episode on JFK's autopsy on Thanksgiving Day. I do hope each and every one of you had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and that if you're blessed this week with an extra day off, you'll be able to find some time over this long weekend to listen to what will be several episodes published as we continue our autopsy series. As you know, when we did the series on the Zapruder film and when we did the Dealey Plaza series, both those series mushroomed in terms of coverage and morphed into quite a few episodes, quite a few parts, if you will, to cover the topic in the way that we wanted to. And the same has already begun to happen here, I suppose. I am trying to keep as many of these episodes as possible to around 30 to 40 minutes each, which is my target length for an episode. That should make it easier to digest. As you know, the Siebert and O'Neill FBI 302 report is the closest we have to a true evidential storytell of the assassination autopsy. And as you know, I really have a preference for going back to the official documents and understanding what's in them first, before we begin to analyze what's right and wrong or what's in conflict, and really before we do any major storytelling. And so I've been out of sequence a little bit in this series already with some of the things that we're doing here in the story of the autopsy, but it's still early on, early enough that it's probably just the right time to introduce the Siebert and O'Neill report in its entirety. It's actually not long at all, and it's chock full of important facts that document what went on in the autopsy, and it also brings up some interesting questions as well. So let's read it together, and that way you'll have a chance to listen to it in its entirety. Like I said, it's not very long, and I think you will find it interesting. Listen closely because there are lots of things that should stick out to you as you listen in. And when we get done, I'll reemphasize some of the more important matters that have been included and that we'll need to keep top of mind as we are evaluating all of this information. As jurors, this is an important part of the evidence being presented. In the episode that follows this one, we are going to do something similar with the actual autopsy report itself, which is even shorter than the Siebert and O'Neill report, and has even less relevant information in it. But again, it is an official report that we need to spend a little bit of time with as we wander through this part of the story. So, here we go. Without further ado, let's listen to episode 68 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. At approximately 3 p.m. on November 22, 1963, following the president's announced assassination, it was ascertained that Air Force One, the president's jet, was returning from Love Field, Dallas, Texas, flying the body back to Andrews Air Force Base, Camp Springs, Maryland. Special agents Francis X. O'Neill, Jr. and James W. Siebert proceeded to Andrews Air Force Base to handle any matters which would fall within the jurisdiction of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, inasmuch as it was anticipated that a large group of both military and civilian personnel assigned to the base would congregate at base operations to witness the landing of this flight. Lieutenant Colonel Robert T. Best, who was the Director of Law Enforcement and Security, advised the President's plane would arrive at 5:25 p.m. Subsequently, Colonel Best advised that the plane would arrive at 6:05 p.m. At approximately 5:55 p.m., agents were advised through the Hyattsville Resident Agency that the Bureau had instructed that the agents accompany the body to the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, to stay with the body and to obtain bullets reportedly in the president's body. Immediately, agents contacted Mr. James Rowley, the director of the U.S. Secret Service, identified themselves, and made Mr. Rowley aware of our aforementioned instruction. Immediately following the plane's landing, Mr. Rowley arranged seating for Bureau agents in the third car of the White House motorcade, which followed the ambulance containing the president's body to the Naval Medical Center, Bethesda, Maryland. On arrival at the medical center, the ambulance stopped in front of the main entrance, at which time Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy embarked from the ambulance and entered the building. The ambulance was, thereafter, driven around to the rear entrance where the president's body was removed and taken into an autopsy room. Bureau agents assisted in the moving of the casket to the autopsy room. A tight security was immediately placed around the autopsy room by the naval facility and the U.S. Secret Service agents. The agents made contact with Mr. Roy Kellerman, the Assistant Secret Service agent in charge of the White House detail, and advised him of the Bureau's interest in this matter. He advised that he had already received instructions from Director Rowley as to the presence of the Bureau agents. It will be noted that the aforementioned Bureau agents and Mr. Roy Kellerman, Mr. William Greer, and Mr. William O'Leary, Secret Service agents, were the only personnel other than medical personnel present during the autopsy. The following individuals attended the autopsy: Admiral C.E. Holloway, U.S. Navy, commanding officer of the U.S. Naval Medical Center in Bethesda; Admiral Berkeley, U.S. Navy, the president's personal physician; Commander James J. Humes, chief pathologist, Bethesda Naval Hospital, who conducted autopsy; Captain James H. Stover, Jr., commanding officer of the Naval Medical School, Bethesda; Mr. John T. Stringer, Jr., medical photographer; James H. Ebersol, Lloyd Rabe, J.T. Bajal, J.G. Rudnicki, Paul O'Connor, J.C. Jenkins, Cheryl Crester, Edward F. Reed, and James Mettler. During the course of the autopsy, Lieutenant Colonel Pierre Fink, U.S. Army Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, arrived to assist Commander Humes in the autopsy. In addition, Lieutenant Commander Greg Cross and Captain David Osborne, Chief of Surgery, entered the autopsy room. Major General Wheel, commanding officer of the U.S. Military District of Washington, D.C., entered the autopsy room to ascertain from the Secret Service agents concerning the transportation of the president's body back to the White House. Chester from the U.S. Navy visited the autopsy room during the final stages of such to type receipts given by FBI and Secret Service for items obtained at the termination of the autopsy. The following personnel from Gawler's funeral home entered the autopsy room to prepare the president's body for burial: John Van Hazen, Edwin Strobel, Thomas Robinson, and Mr. Hagen. Brigadier General Godfrey McHugh, Air Force military aide to the president, was also present, as was Dr. George Bakeman, U.S. Navy. Arrangements were made for the performance of the autopsy by the U.S. Navy and Secret Service. The president's body was removed from the casket in which it had been transported and was placed on the autopsy table, at which time the complete body was wrapped in a sheet and the head area contained an additional wrapping which was saturated with blood. Following the removal of the wrapping, it was ascertained that the president's clothing had been removed, and it was also apparent that a tracheotomy had been performed, as well as surgery of the head area, namely in the top of the skull. All personnel, with the exception of medical officers needed in the taking of the photographs and x-rays, were requested to leave the autopsy room and remain in an adjacent room. Upon completion of x-rays and photographs, the first incision was made at 8:15 p.m. X-rays of the brain area, which were developed and returned to the autopsy room, disclosed a path of a missile which appeared to enter the back of the skull, and the path of the disintegrated fragments could be observed along the right side of the skull. The largest section of this missile, as portrayed by X-ray, appeared to be behind the right frontal sinus. The next largest fragment appeared to be at the rear of the skull, at the juncture of the skull bone. The chief pathologist advised approximately 40 particles of disintegrated bullet and smudges indicated that the projectile had fragmentized while passing through the skull region. During the autopsy inspection of the area of the brain, two fragments of metal were removed by Dr. Humes, namely one fragment measuring 7 by 2 millimeters, which was removed from the right side of the brain. An additional fragment of metal measuring 1 by 3 millimeters was also removed from this area, both of which were placed in a glass jar containing a black metal top, which were thereafter marked for identification and, following the signing of a proper receipt, were transported by Bureau agents to the FBI laboratory during the latter stages of this autopsy. Dr. Humes located an opening, which appeared to be a bullet hole, which was below the shoulders and 2 inches to the right of the middle line of the spinal column. This opening was probed by Dr. Humes with the finger, at which time it was determined that the trajectory of the missile entering at this point had entered at a downward position of 45 to 60 degrees. Further probing determined that the distance traveled by this missile was a short distance, inasmuch as the end of the opening could be felt with the finger. Inasmuch as no complete bullet of any size could be located in the brain area, and likewise no bullet could be located in the back or any other area of the body, as determined by total body X-rays and inspection as well, revealing there was no point of exit. The individuals performing the autopsy were at a loss to explain why they could find no bullets. A call was made by Bureau agents to the firearms section of the FBI laboratory, at which time Special Agent Charles Killian advised that the laboratory had received, through Secret Service Agent Richard Johnson, a bullet which had reportedly been found on a stretcher in the emergency room of Parkland Hospital, Dallas, Texas. This stretcher had also contained a stethoscope and a pair of rubber gloves. Agent Johnson had advised the laboratory that it had not been ascertained whether or not this was the stretcher which had been used to transport the body of President Kennedy. Agent Killian further described this bullet as pertaining to a 6.5 millimeter rifle, which could be approximately a 25 caliber rifle, and that this bullet consisted of a copper alloy full jacket. Immediately following receipt of this information, I made this available to Dr. Humes, who advised that, in his opinion, this accounted for no bullet being located, which had entered the back region, and that since external cardiac massage had been performed at Parkland Hospital, it was entirely possible that through such movement, the bullet had worked its way back out of the point of entry and had fallen onto the stretcher. Also, during the latter stages of the autopsy, a piece of the skull measuring 10 by 6.5 centimeters was brought to Dr. Humes, who was instructed that this had been removed from the president's skull. Immediately, this section of skull was X-rayed, at which time it was determined by Dr. Humes that one corner of this section revealed minute medical particles. An inspection of this same area disclosed a chipping of the top portion of this piece, both of which indicated that this had been the point of exit of the bullet entering the skull region. On the basis of the latter two developments, Dr. Humes stated that the pattern was clear, that the one bullet had entered the president's back and had worked its way out of the body during external cardiac massage, and that a second high-velocity bullet had entered the rear of the skull and had fragmentized prior to exit through the top of the skull. He further pointed out that X-rays had disclosed numerous fractures in the cranial area, which he attributed to the force generated by the impact of the bullet in its passage through the brain area. He attributed the death of the president to a gunshot wound in the head. The following is a complete listing of the photographs and x-rays taken by the medical authorities of the president's body. They were turned over to Mr. Roy Kellerman of the Secret Service. X-rays were developed by the hospital. However, the photographs were delivered to the Secret Service undeveloped. 11 x-rays, 22 4x5 color photographs, 18 4x5 black and white photographs, one roll of 120 film containing 5 exposures. Mr. Kellerman stated these items could be made available to the FBI upon request. The portion of the skull measuring 10 by 6.5 centimeters was maintained in the custody of Dr. Humes, who stated that it also could be made available for further examination. The two metal fragments removed from the brain area were hand-carried by Special Agents Siebert and O'Neill to the FBI laboratory immediately following the autopsy and were turned over to Special Agent Kurt Frazier. As I mentioned in the prologue, it's worth emphasizing some of the points that were in the Siebert and O'Neill report. Even though the report itself is simply written and easy to evaluate on its own, so at the risk of being redundant, which many of you know I am going to do just that. First, it's clear that the objective of the autopsy was to retrieve bullets, and I emphasize the term bullets, plural, rather than singular, whether that is splitting a fine point for no reason. Well, I'm not sure. But the point is, the stated principal objective of the autopsy was to recover bullets. Bullets that presumably could be connected. Connected to what? Well, although it was not directly stated, connected to the Mannlicher Carcano rifle. Supposedly Oswald's rifle. The plural reference at the outset of the autopsy is interesting, since they were unaware at the outset of the autopsy that a second bullet had hit the president in the back. That was discovered during the course of the autopsy. Since this report was written after the autopsy was completed, and evidence of at least two bullets was actually found during the autopsy, the writing style used by Siebert and O'Neill may have just simply adopted the plural instead of the singular. Oh well, I'll just let that dog lie. The report explicitly says that the ambulance was driven around from the front after the dropping off of Jackie and Robert, and then driven right around to the back to the morgue. This fact is important as we understand the chain of custody of the bronze casket. A related part of the report that has become a bit of a controversial topic relates to the statement in the report where they indicate that a tight security was immediately placed around the autopsy room. That security was never discussed in detail within the report, and in later years, it did come under some scrutiny by David Lifton. Difficult for me to understand the impact of this, but for those who read Lifton's discussion, you will get how this fits into his narrative around how surgery on the body could have happened. The report emphasizes that besides the inventory of Secret Service and FBI agents, only medical personnel of some sort were in attendance. We know that from an earlier episode. There are some misspellings in the report. For instance, you may have heard me say Gerald Crester, when proper spelling is Gerald Custer, for example. The report indicates that General Philip Wheel did enter the room once. You remember Wheel from a previous episode and his aide-de-camp, Robert Lipsey. According to the report, Wheel entered simply to discuss arrangements to transport the president's body back to the White House after the autopsy. But interestingly, as we have already noted, no mention at all in the report of the presence of Robert Lipsey in the room. Quite a contrary discussion from Lipsey's story where he himself tells of his own involvement, and he swore to it under oath. The report confirms the existence of Mr. Chester, who was there to provide receipts of items given to the Secret Service and the FBI, and that he did, both for the bullet fragments that were removed and the undeveloped photographic film, that is, the pictures of the autopsy that were taken, and not seen, by the way, by the autopsy participants at that time. The report confirms the taking of x-rays at the outset of the autopsy, and they are also very explicit that all non-medical attendees were asked to leave the room while the x-rays and autopsy photos were being taken. The report confirms that the actual autopsy itself started around 8:15, affixing and confirming that there was a good 90 minutes or so between when the body arrived on site at Bethesda and when the actual autopsy officially got underway. The report discusses the reveal of the president as he is removed from the casket, confirming that the body was wrapped in two sheets, one of those sheets wrapped around his head and covered with blood. And the significance of this is that the president was not described as being in a body bag. He was described as being wrapped consistent with how personnel at Parkland said they wrapped him before he left the hospital. Again, this point is important when we explore the concept of whether or not the president actually arrived in a shipping casket and not the bronze casket. The report notes the existence of a tracheotomy wound. How they determined it was that, whether it was ID'd immediately by the pathologist as such, was not indicated. But between the two, that is, Siebert and O'Neill, they had elementary anatomical training, which helped as they witnessed the autopsy. They knew the basic science and technique around what they were listening to and watching, and maybe they just understood that. They do not state that the pathologist identified this as such and stated that as such. The report also contains the famous surgery of the head comment, which is perhaps one of the most famous quotes in the document and the most controversial. It seems even more perplexing when you listen to the exact language used in the report. And I quote, "It was apparent that a tracheotomy had been performed as well as surgery of the head area, namely in the top of the skull," end quote. Well, that is pretty specific, surgery in the top of the skull. So, years later, Siebert would try to explain away this comment, saying that the head surgery comment was really related to the tracheotomy comment, all sort of in one sentence. But honestly, from the language in the report, it's pretty clear that the surgery to the head comment is totally unrelated to the comment about the tracheotomy. So really, what did they mean at that moment? That there was surgery to the head as the body was revealed? It really does seem like there is a need for a better explanation than Siebert's explanation that he gave in later years. Even though he and O'Neill are the only ones who truly knew what they meant when they originally wrote this report. Next, the report says that the x-ray reports that were developed and returned to the autopsy room disclosed a path that did show the rear entrance of the bullet to the president's head. I think that's important. The report also confirmed that the x-rays shown at that time indicated a spray of fragments distributed through the president's brain on the right side of the brain. Actually, they use the term skull. The report also confirms that the largest bullet fragment appeared to be lodged behind the right frontal sinus, while the second largest was lodged in the rear of the head. The report also confirms the removal of two metal fragments during the work on the brain, one measuring 7 by 2 millimeters and the other measuring 1 by 3 millimeters, and that they were both placed in a jar with a black metal top and then marked for identification and then sent along their way to the FBI lab, actually personally hand-delivered by Siebert and O'Neill to Kurt Frazier. And as we know, the next step was to link those two fragments to the Mannlicher Carcano rifle. In one of the more important statements within the report documents that Humes would find the bullet hole in the president's back and place his finger in it and realize that it traversed only a short distance into his back. The quote is clear. And I quote, "The distance traveled by this missile was a short distance, inasmuch as the end of the opening could be felt with a finger." The report confirms that there were no whole bullets found during the autopsy, only fragments. Here is the quote again to reemphasize. Begin the quote. Inasmuch as no complete bullet of any size could be located in the brain area, and likewise, no bullet could be located in the back or any other area of the body, as determined by total body x-rays and inspection revealing there was no point of exit, the individuals performing the autopsy were at a loss to explain why they could find no bullets. The report then confirmed that during the autopsy, the FBI lab had received the bullet that was found at Parkland on a stretcher. So this was all known during the course of the autopsy. And that the bullet was found with gloves and a stethoscope on the stretcher as well. But there was no confirmation that the stretcher was the one that President Kennedy was placed on. The report was clear about that. All of that was communicated to Siebert and O'Neill during the autopsy and then relayed immediately by them to Humes during the autopsy. This is the bullet that we now know as the pristine bullet, the magic bullet, which became Commission Exhibit 399. Only at that moment, the conclusions that they made that night in the autopsy room was that this is the bullet that worked its way out of the president's back. Interestingly, the report stated that Agent Johnson, who had possession of the magic bullet, had recognized it already as a 6.5 millimeter shell, exactly equal to the shell size of the Mannlicher Carcano rifle, implying that they realized, or at least stated, almost immediately that it was a match with the Italian rifle. And that was communicated rather quickly to the autopsy group that night. The report also confirms that Humes made a very explicit statement after he heard the statement on the discovery of the stretcher bullet. During the autopsy, he would say that, and I quote, in his opinion, this situation accounted for which bullet had entered the back region, and that since external cardiac massage had been performed at Parkland Hospital, it was entirely possible that through such movement, the bullet had worked its way back out of the point of entry and had fallen onto the stretcher. The report also acknowledges the skull fragment being delivered during the course of the autopsy and the work that Humes and the pathologist did to determine how that piece fit into the picture. As we know, it was actually more than one fragment. Based on what they found and what was delivered and what they pieced together, they were able to find and conclude on a point of exit in the head. And this led to the statement and the quote, and I quote, that a bullet had entered the rear of the president's skull and fragmentized prior to exit at the top of the skull. The statement would later prove to be somewhat controversial as it confirmed the entry wound lower in the back of the skull and exiting higher in the head. A contrary entry and exit path for a bullet that was traveling originally from high up in the school book depository at a 21-degree downward angle. All right, let's pause for a second. Wow, that's a lot. I just counted 22 different key facts we just went over. Maybe more. There is a whole lot packed into that report. Now that we are armed with that, let's sit back and digest it. And then in the next episode, we will listen to the autopsy report itself. That'll be a short exercise. Sadly, a short exercise. Thank you for listening to episode 68 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.